Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we explore the political ethos of hacktivist group Anonymous. And first, the dark side of Uber, Airbnb, and the rest of the so-called sharing economy. With us is Stephen Hill. He is a senior fellow with the New America Foundation, co-founder of Fair Vote, Center for Voting and Democracy, and the author of Fixing Elections, Europe's Promise, and his latest, Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Naked Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. Well, welcome back to the Scholar Circle. It's been a long time, and it's great to have you back with us. Let's start with this concept you've talked about, which is really the sharing economy is not really about sharing. So there are a lot of these new companies that you've been talking about, Lyft and Uber and TaskRabbit and Airbnb. How many of these are there generally that you see as calling themselves sharing but really are not?
The two 800-pound gorillas, so to speak, are Uber and Airbnb. Uber is valued at $51 billion, Airbnb at $25 billion. That makes Uber almost with a valuation equal to General Motors, Ford Motor Company, bigger than Tesla Motors. Even though they haven't built a single car, they own virtually nothing. They don't even really claim to hire employees because all the people that work for them are contractors. So that's rather astounding to think that a company could have so much value on paper yet not have so many real assets whatsoever. And the same with Airbnb. They have no real assets, and yet they're supposedly valued more than, you know, the Hilton, Sheraton, and all these other hotel chains. So there's a lot of froth around these companies and how much they're really valued if they eventually go IPO route, which they presumably will, remains to be seen. But it's a reflection of how much, you know, the venture capital money is lining up behind these companies, and they really see it as a thing of the future.
So there are several aspects of the growth of these companies that are really important. One is that they tout themselves as one thing, you know, you don't have to work for the man anymore. But on the other side, you see it as part of this big trend in neoliberal economics, in which people are increasingly working at all hours, using their own assets, and losing the things that they used to have in terms of stability and retirement and healthcare. Let's start with the sense of being deceptive about you don't have to work for the man anymore. Is that deceptive, really?
Yes, it really is. Sometimes they say you can be the CEO of your own business, either your own driving business or your own hotel business by renting out something on Airbnb. You know, you can be the CEO of your own cleaning business by working through TaskRabbit or through Upwork and some of these other labor platforms. And, you know, the last time I looked, most CEOs are making millions of dollars. And so when they lose their job, they don't have to scurry to find the next job. But in this so-called sharing economy, what I call the share the crumbs economy, they really are redefining how we conceive of as work. For many decades, it's been the case that, you know, you have a job, you go to that job from 9 to 5 or 8 to 4, and every minute you're at that job, you're paid, whether it's doing your work or if you're going to a meeting with coworkers or you're at the water cooler with coworkers, it's all paid time. Now, with this new type of economy, what they're saying is you'll only be paid for that exact moment that you're producing that report or producing a logo, a graphic file for the person who's contracted for you or the law brief or whatever you've been hired to do. That's the only thing you're paid for. You're not paid for if you have to go to any meetings in order to finish that project. You're not paid to look for your next job as soon as that one's over, and so you're constantly scrambling to find that next job. You don't get any safety net or health benefits or anything of this kind. There's no job security. What the people would say in response to that is that you have flexibility. You can work when you want. Certainly flexibility is a nice thing, but when the jobs aren't paying very much and you don't have a safety net, you don't even have injured worker compensation. Many of these workers get injured on the job and they have no compensation. They pay for their health care themselves and the injury themselves, and then they have to pay if they miss work out of their own pocket. So, this is not a great situation for many, many workers.
You also mentioned in your book that a lot of people really end up working for less than minimum wage, and they're just working all the time. So where is the flexibility in that?
Right. If you have to always look for the next job and you're not ever making enough money to be able to just relax a little bit, You're basically always wired. You're always on the go. You know, some of the people I've interviewed who are trying to make a go of it through this gig economy, I mean, they just have numerous complaints along these lines of not only, you know, they show up for a gig and the person who they're supposed to work for flaked it off and they forgot. And so they don't get paid for that. The platforms themselves take anywhere from 25% to 30%. That's what Uber takes. You know, TaskRabbit takes more like around 20% of every job. But some of the workers complain that it's not really transparent. They're not even sure what percentage these companies are actually taking. Some of them are complaining that these companies are taking 35% to 40% of every job. You know, so there's just a lot of complaints like this that we're hearing from people who are trying to make a go of it, but it's just not going very well.
There are a couple of other perspectives that you brought in with this book as well that I think are interesting that other people haven't covered. And that is, for example, people who already own, say, property in a car are in a completely different boat than the people who are not in the ownership situation and just have their labor to sell. And so this so-called sharing economy treats them differently. How can you help us understand that?
Well, so say if you're an Uber driver, you're basically asked, they call it monetizing your assets, where you use your own property to try and bring in income. In the book, I have the story of Fred Larson, who is a prize-winning photographer with the San Francisco Chronicle. He was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. This is a very successful professional. He got downsized by the Chronicle during the economic recession, and so he lost his job. He was really too young to retire, but too old to really start some whole new profession. I mean, he already had a very successful profession. He didn't really know what to do. He was kind of lost for a while. And so, you know, he decided, well, I could, you know, he hears this about monetizing your assets. He actually owned a home in Marin County, fairly nice place. He could start renting that out on Airbnb, bringing in some income. So it sounds like, well, okay, at least he had that option, which is better than nothing, which is certainly true. But on the other hand, now when he's renting out 40% of the month is about how much he rents out his house, he's sequestered in one little room in his house. He has to shower at the local gym while complete strangers have the run of his home. Okay, sure, it's better than nothing. But on the other hand, this man is a professional photographer. He's, you know, extremely good at what he does, and he's an innkeeper and a taxi driver now because of what's happened to his career. You know, I hear this story over and over again from lots of people. Yes, monetizing your assets, if you have nothing else going for you, it's better than having no income at all. But, you know, the idea that somehow this is a viable thing for many, many people is just simply, you know, looking at this situation and not realizing the big picture of what's happening to jobs in the United States and what's happening to workers.
And I don't think it's just in the United States either. I've seen it in other places as well. So let's put this into the larger economic employment context. We know globally wages and real income are declining for most people, and that in many places, especially in the United States, we're increasingly a freelance society. Give us the big picture and how this new so-called sharing economy fits into it.
Well, the big picture is that in the aftermath of the Great Recession, which is a global phenomena, the quality of the jobs has deteriorated. You know, we can look at all sorts of indicators to show that corporate profits are at an all-time high, and yet the number of jobs they're creating is at an all-time low. And the number of workers that have good jobs, which would be defined as, you know, having a decent wage, having a safety net through that job, having a measure of job security, those jobs have also declined. Instead, we're seeing a lot of jobs, like one of the people I feature in my book, a fellow by the name of Chris Young. He's an auto worker at a Nissan plant in Tennessee. Chris, he works alongside of all the other workers there, but he doesn't get to wear the Nissan shirt like all the other Nissan workers do, even though he's doing the exact same job, because he doesn't work for Nissan. He works for a contractor. And as working for that contractor, he gets half the pay, no safety net, no job security for doing the exact same job as everyone else. And I have a lot of people like that in my book that are features of these sorts of workers who are becoming contractors, freelancers, temp workers. Chris Young is actually what's called a perma temp because he's been in this temporary job for several years. So it's not very temporary anymore. You know, some of these workers, these perma temps, are there for 4, 5, 6, 7 years. And so this is what's happening to jobs. In the aftermath of the Great Recession, about a fifth of the jobs created in the United States are temp jobs. And these jobs don't pay very much compared to the jobs that were lost. So you have to look at all this in that kind of context. And the reason why an employer looks to hire these sorts of workers now is because they lower their labor costs by 30% because they're not paying for things like health care, Social Security, Medicare. They're not even paying for injured worker compensation, unemployment compensation, none of these safety net features that we've had as part of various jobs for decades are included in these sorts of jobs. So, you know, if I'm an employer and you're an employer and I'm hiring contractors and temps and you're not, that's going to put you at a competitive disadvantage. And so you start doing it too, and it just becomes a race to the bottom, and we're seeing more and more examples like that in the United States as well as other countries around the world. As these jobs, the quality of jobs deteriorates and the amount of pay, U.S. workers have not had a pay increase now in about 25 years. Wages have been flat the entire time. And so we know that the economy is driven 70% by consumer spending. And if we reach a point where not enough workers have enough money in their pockets to buy up the goods and services that are being produced by the businesses, at that point you introduce ongoing recessionary dynamics into the economy. It's like you get hurt by a deflationary cycle in which no one has enough money to buy. Employers are laying people off because they don't have enough customers, and so you get in that downward cycle. And at that point, we reach this point of economic singularity where the tipping point where there's just simply not enough consumer demand in the economy to keep a capitalist economy going. Fewer and fewer people control the economy and can extract the good that's in the economy for their own personal gain.
Another thing I found interesting is that this is affecting people of all education levels, of all walks of life, other than those very few who are at the very, very top.
Yes, I mean, especially with what's going on with automation and artificial intelligence, robots and such, we're seeing that it's not just sort of the workers on the assembly line that you think of as the ones who are going to be replaced. That is has been happening and will continue to happen. But it's also people holding professional degrees, like certain things that doctors do, reading x-rays and MRIs. It turns out you can make a computer do that much easier. They can do it faster and in some ways more accurately than a human can. You know, in my book, I have a story about a robot called PillTech. It can suck pills out of a tray. It can put them into a plastic envelope, slap a label on there with a barcode that says what's in it and who the patient is supposed to, who the patient is that's supposed to take these, and then it's taken off by the human. So, you know, that's going to replace your local pharmacist. There are programs now, computers that can write news stories. They can, especially anything that's data-oriented, sports stories and things about financial markets, they can take that data set and a computer program can write a story based around that data. You know, it's kind of bland sounding, but no more so than many journalists today. And they've actually tested these, and then a lot of people reading them can't tell if a human or a robot wrote these stories. So there's many, many occupations that become extremely more sophisticated in designing these algorithms. Many more occupations are going to be ripe for being disrupted by these technologies.
What this piece that your book is ultimately bringing forward, which is the Uber society, the Airbnb society, how does it fit in with this economic singularity idea?
Well, you know, what these companies are pioneering, in a sense, in this app-driven type of company, is a way to make it so easy to hire and fire workers that businesses will not really have an incentive to hire regularly employed workers anymore. It'll just be easier to just hire someone for a day or a week, and then you fire them. And you don't have to, by doing that, you don't have any relationship with them. You know, it used to be the relationship between an employer and employee, it was somewhat of a marriage. You know, you each had a vested interest in the other succeeding. The employer wanted the employee to be good at what she or he did. They wanted them to be trained and have high productivity because that translated to higher profits. It was a marriage in that sense. And now it's just kind of a bunch of one-night stands. And this is what the Uber economy and Airbnb economy is all about, just you know, people coming in to a neighborhood that used to be a community, and now there's just a bunch of Airbnb hotels that are, people have been evicted from buildings in San Francisco. I have interviewed a lot of them, and they're in my book, where people who've lived in these buildings for 20, 25 years, and suddenly they're evicted to turn it into an Airbnb hotel, and there goes your any sense of community. So it's just kind of creating this disposable society that is supposed to be good for us. That's what they tell us.
I think that's a really important piece, this aspect of landlords who might have had long-term tenants who don't want to be rent-controlled anymore. They make more money with Airbnb, and so they might as well evict their long-term tenants. How much is this happening?
It's happening in certain cities quite a lot. San Francisco, New York City, Los Angeles, Venice Beach, Santa Monica, all being hit with this quite dramatic numbers at this point. I mean, there was a Coldwell Banker memo that was accidentally leaked. It was a memo going to a lot of real estate operatives and basically saying you can double your revenue by renting out your property on Airbnb rather than renting it to local residents. So, I mean, this type of business has literally ripped open a loophole in local laws that were there to protect tenants. I mean, most cities have a law that says you can't rent out a property for fewer than 30 days, and those laws have been on the books for decades. And they were there precisely to prevent your housing stock from being handed over to tourists instead of to local residents. And now Airbnb has made it so easy to do with its platform that it's ripped open this huge loophole, so that Airbnb has been at this point completely invaded by professional real estate operatives. Independent analyses of their websites have found that 40 to 50% of Airbnb's revenue at this point comes from professionals, not from the so-called regular people that Airbnb likes to feature in its ads and what have you, you know, the regular people who are renting out a spare room in their home. Those people are still on the platform, and I actually think it's fine that they're doing that, but the reality is that increasingly Airbnb's business model is being one of these business, these real estate professionals that are taking over everything. And, you know, some of these hosts have dozens of properties. In New York City, some hosts have over 200 properties that they control. I mean, these are not regular people. And Airbnb knows this. They have their numbers. They're aware of their numbers more than anyone. And if they wanted to, with just one flick of a computer mouse, they could wipe off these multi-property hosts. But they don't, because they're making a ton of money from them. And in fact, increasingly, this is becoming what Airbnb is.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar's Circle, scholarscircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the dark side of the so-called sharing economy. There are other aspects that you touch on in the book that is related to this, is that local regulations and laws are actually upended by some of these companies. And now the other piece is that revenues for a lot of cities come from hospitality and hotels, but you don't get it from Airbnb. So what about the local regs and the local taxes and local laws? What is the overall effect?
The overall effect is less revenue for city governments because, you know, cities depend on a hotel tax. They depend on the livery tax that taxi companies pay, and Airbnb doesn't pay hotel taxes generally. Uber and ride sharing don't pay the livery tax. So these cities are missing out on revenue by having these rogue operators, you know, these kind of, I call them sort of pirate companies, just breaking the laws and refusing to follow them. I mean, you know, a classic example, I mean, Airbnb, they claim they're operating in 34,000 cities. They're now paying taxes in about a dozen of those, just a tiny, tiny percentage. And, you know, their latest attempt to sound like they're the nice guy, they're saying, we want to be regulated, but, you know, there's just so many cities we're operating in, and we can't possibly figure out all the laws so quick and all the tax laws and what have you. And so they're basically saying, we're hoping to get to them over time. Well, you know, if you're, say, DuPont, you can't set up a chemical plant in India or in Korea or anywhere else and say, we're going to set up operations first and figure out the tax laws and the regulations second. If you're Google or Apple, you can't do that anywhere. I mean, Airbnb and Uber are asserting this new corporate right to set up operations first and figure out all the tax and local regulations second. they have the, in exact reverse order. And if we let all corporations do this sort of thing, it would be complete chaos.
So it's a bit of a lawlessness that goes along with these companies.
Absolutely. I call them pirate companies. They are themselves breaking laws and avoiding taxes, and they encourage the people that use their businesses to do the same. You know, Airbnb hosts, some of them are the regular people, and, you know, I think they should be able to figure out a way to allow them to do that to make some spare money in a bad economy. But those people also should be paying the hotel tax. And in San Francisco, for example, San Francisco passed a law requiring all hosts to register with the city. And, you know, now that this law has been in effect for many months, only 10% of the hosts have registered. They're all, so the other 90% are all operating illegally, and no one seems to think that they should have to follow these laws that have been put in place to make the way legal for Airbnb. So even when the city, like San Francisco and Portland and others, have tried to legalize this, they still don't follow the law.
Then there are also regulations around safety issues, particularly with drivers and with where you stay. If you're a normal hotel, you do have to have certain kinds of safety measures to protect the people who stay there and with your car. What happens with these situations?
Well, they're not following any of the laws on safety or fire hazards or anything like this. In fact, I became an Airbnb host after I watched an interview between Airbnb CEO Brian Chesky and Katie Couric. And Katie Couric asked Chesky about fire and safety and all these sorts of things. And first he said, we have almost 200 people working on safety and, you know, to make sure our hosts are doing a good job and really sort of try to make it sound like there's some human there that's watching over all this. So I thought, well, I'll become a host. And I took photos of my house inside and out. And within 15 minutes, I was live as a host. Within an hour, I had my first request for an Airbnb rental, even though I had no contact with a human. There was no contact even by email. I mean, absolutely nothing. I mean, it was both impressive and kind of appalling that it would be so easy to simply set up a hotel in my neighborhood just like that. And then they also said in terms of fire that they actually offered to their hosts a free smoke and carbon monoxide alarm. So I applied for my free smoke and carbon monoxide alarm, sent an email to them, made a phone call, got the runaround. They sent me to a website, then to another website. And in the end, it turned out that alarm didn't even exist. So, you know, this is the type of smoke and mirrors you get with these companies where they just seem to just make up stuff and hope that they don't get discovered. Well, let's do it first. And if we get found out, then we'll apologize later. That seems to be their operational strategy.
And I suppose there's also the issue. Now, I was once a taxi cab commissioner in the city of Los Angeles, and there is a whole process to getting a license to drive a taxi cab. And if a cab driver commits crime, then they lose their license. But there's no such regulatory process for Uber drivers, for example. You could be getting into a car with anybody.
I mean, Uber claims that they do background checks, which they do, but the background checks are not as thorough as they are that taxi companies have to do. They don't do fingerprint checks, for example, which is kind of considered the state of the art. If you're not doing fingerprint checks, you're really not doing a very thorough job. And for that reason, the district attorneys of Los Angeles and San Francisco have both sued Uber because Uber actually charges for every ride $2 for a safe ride fee, and claiming that they do, you know, the best background checks in the industry. So they sued them for misrepresenting the safety of their rides as well as what they do with this $2 fee. So, you know, there's been numerous examples at this point of drivers who the background checks were not adequate. And, you know, you certainly have these problems in taxis as well, but that's not a good excuse for you know, theirs aren't any good either, so we don't have to do anything better. San Francisco, there was a driver a couple of New Year's Eves ago who he turned into the crosswalk, plowed over a family who was in the crosswalk, killed a 6-year-old girl, and badly injured her brother and her mother. And the Uber's immediate response was, doesn't have anything to do with us. This is a driver. He's a contractor. He's his own CEO of his own driving business. We don't have any liability here. However, the reality was that driver had been arrested for negligent driving in Florida for going 100 miles an hour on a city street trying to pass someone. So they wash their hands of these things, and yet there's obvious culpability. It's just kind of ironic that, you know, any pizza delivery driver, from the moment they're in that car until they make the delivery and get back to home base, they are completely covered with insurance. But when it comes to Uber and these ride-sharing companies, the insurance situation remains extremely murky.
Let's turn to solutions. You had lots of potential solutions.
Top one that's getting the most attention right now is about how to create a safety net for these sorts of workers. Because, you know, the way it's worked for decades is most people had a single employer, and you work for that employer for, you know, close to full-time, if not full-time, and you often work for that employer for many years. And so that's who you got a lot of your safety net support from. But increasingly, more and more workers have multiple employers. Many times they don't work enough hours at any one job to qualify for any benefits. In fact, it's purposeful. A lot of these businesses, you know, they say, well, if you work above 25 or 30 hours, you get a certain amount of safety net, you get health care and these things. But then the businesses just make sure that you never work that number of hours. And so you have a lot of workers who are working part-time from multiple employers, and they're not ever getting enough hours in any one to qualify for a safety net. So what I and some other people have been proposing is a new method that would basically say that any business who hires any worker, regardless of that worker is a contractor or a regularly employed worker, you would pay a certain amount into an individual security account for that worker. And the amount you pay would be prorated to the number of hours that that worker works for you. And then this money that goes into this account would be used to pay for the safety net for this worker. And it would go into existing infrastructure like Social Security, Medicare, injured worker, unemployment compensation, health care, these sorts of things. So the money would just, you know, automatically, it would go into the individual secure account, and then it would go back out to these other infrastructure accounts that already exist. And so by doing this, we would allow workers to work for however many employers they need to make it work, and not feel like they're being shut out of some of the other good things that a good job brings. So that is one of the primary ones. And this is something that, you know, many countries around the world already do. The U.S. is kind of an outlier here in so many ways in not already having something like this in place due to historical reasons of the safety net and jobs and the unions and how they negotiated contracts and such. So that's the primary proposal that I've made. And it's getting some pickup from different, you know, players in this arena. Just recently, there was a statement of principles put out by 40 business, labor, and political leaders saying that they're endorsing this idea of what we're calling portable benefits. Portable meaning you can go take your benefits with you from job to job. So seeing that it's getting that kind of take-up is good, and we'll see if where it goes from here. New York Times just reported on these 40 business and labor leaders, you know, signing the statement of principle. So it's starting to get a little bit of national attention.
There was another one that you mentioned that I thought sounded really interesting, and that was called job sharing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, job sharing is something that has been used very successfully in places like Germany and other countries, where you, particularly, for example, in the last, in this Great Recession, in the U.S., we had tons of businesses laying off a lot of workers. Well, what they did in Germany was instead of laying off a bunch of people, everybody cut back a little bit. So instead of working 100% full-time, you're working 90% or 85%. And then they are able to keep more people employed by, you know, using that 10 or 15% that you're taking from another worker and giving it to other workers. And Germany had set aside some money during the better years in which allowed them to not have to reduce workers' pay dollar for dollar, hour for hour. So by doing this, you keep more consumer spending going, more people have money in their pockets. You don't end up with the devastation that you see when you start doing massive layoffs to families with increases of alcoholism, domestic violence, drug abuse, increases in crime, all the sorts of things that are associated with layoffs like that. Germany and other countries in Europe were able to avoid. So this is something that we should be doing here in the U.S. You know, it also allows more workers to have more time off. A lot of workers appreciate not having to work 40, 45, 50 hours a week and being able to cut back and spend more time with their families, at least for a period of time. So job sharing, I think, is something that has a lot of potential if we were to implement it more.
Stephen Hill, thank you so much for being with us here again on the Scholar Circle.
Great, Maria. It's been my pleasure, as always.
Stephen Hill is a senior fellow with the New America Foundation, co-founder of Fair Vote, Center for Voting and Democracy, and the author of Fixing Elections, Europe's Promise, and his latest, Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Naked Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. When we come back, in light of the cyber attacks on the so-called Islamic State, we explore the political ethos of hacktivist group Anonymous. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. After the Islamic State, or ISIS, attacked French civilians in Paris, the hacktivist group Anonymous decided to turn its cyber weapons against the extremist group. Previous targets have included the Church of Scientology and the consultant group Stratfor. What is the driving political ethos of Anonymous? With us is Luke Good. He's a senior lecturer in media, film, and television at the University of Auckland and the author of the book Jürgen Habermas, Democracy in the Public Sphere. He has also published widely on social media, citizen journalism, and hacktivism. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Luke Good. It's great to have you here with us.
No, thanks for having me.
You've been studying these hacktivist groups as well as slacktivist groups and fitting them within some sort of political understanding about what they really are. I thought maybe we should start with how many groups roughly are there that are significant and how did they emerge? What are these hacktivists?
Well, there are a range of different groups, and even a group like Anonymous is a sort of umbrella term for various subgroups that sometimes split away from Anonymous. That particular grouping that's become so prominent in recent years really emerged out of a kind of subculture of kind of hacking and pranksterism, and really this sort of politicized activism part of it really grew after that. That wasn't really the sort of necessarily the driver that got this whole thing started. There have been other groups in the past, like people hacking in support of Zapatistas, for example, and that's one of the sort of famous examples from the past, in which the political project is what gets this thing going. Anonymous is rather different. You know, it comes out of online subculture and a growing anger towards attempts to regulate the net, attempts to censor, attempts by groups to shut down arguments and opinions that are antagonistic toward them. So it's a kind of really interesting and very diverse and at times seemingly kind of amorphous kind of collective, if you like.
You had named a few others in this paper that you published about Anonymous. I think one was Cult of the Dead Cow. One was called Electronic Disturbance Theater. How do these all fit together? Are there people who cross over?
It's difficult to know how much crossover there is. These groups have sort of emerged and become prominent at different periods in the internet's relatively short history. But I think what sort of connects them is this merging of political activism, hacking, and a kind of performance as well. There's a kind of dramatic performance that goes along with these activities, which makes them highly visible and, for many people, kind of entertaining to watch, as well as sort of hard to pin down and hard to characterize.
Now, it's because they are anonymous, how can we, as scholars or even journalists, have a sense of how many people are involved? How do they become anonymous? Can they get thrown out of Anonymous? Without identities, without any kind of structure, how do you know?
Yeah, sure. This stuff is hard to track. And my own work, actually, I have to say, is not really designed to get sort of inside that organization. So, for example, the most prominent anthropologist, if you like, of Anonymous would be Gabriella Coleman, who's actually done a lot of work actually with members of Anonymous. And there have been journalistic accounts that have got quite close to some of the key figures within Anonymous. There was a documentary by Brian Knappenberger a few years ago, which cast Anonymous in what for many people would be a kind of new sort of light and showed real faces to these people. And
not
so,
the Guy Fawkes face?
Well, it actually sort of looked behind the Guy Fawkes face for some members. It was only a small snapshot, but it gave you an interesting insight into the kinds of backgrounds that some of the members come from, the certain kind of demographic profile, although we need to be careful not to stereotype, because actually there are people from different walks of life increasingly joining in these activities. It's easy to stereotype Anonymous as basically young male geeks, because that might be the dominant demographic kind of sort of makeup, but it is actually more diverse than that. And the whole idea of Anonymous is precisely that, and it's a problematic idea in many ways, the idea that sort of identity, one's identity and one's background are somehow irrelevant and can be set aside, and that it's what goes on online that is important. And so that's in many ways sort of premised on, you know, the idea, and it, in some ways it seems like a sort of slightly old-fashioned idea now, that was very prominent with the emergence and popularization of the internet and in its sort of early days, was this idea of a kind of clear split between one's online and one's offline existence and identity.
One of the things you were trying to assess is, what is the political ethos of Anonymous? Sure. And it really seems to have a split personality in many ways, kind of fitting in with populism on one side. You talked about a nihilism versus idealism, for example, and how maybe both are present. How does this manifest itself?
I think before we get into some of those sort of tensions or contradictions even within a group like Anonymous, we should perhaps put it in a bit of context and sort of recognize that political movements are very often draw on contradictory or have sort of ideological or ethical kind of tensions within them. So that's sort of not unique. But I think I was struck when trying to, by looking at the ethos of Anonymous, I think I'm interested in the discourse that they use, the words that they use to express their beliefs. I'm interested in the way that this evokes some of their sort of passions and emotions, the sort of anger and also sort of hope for the future. And I think I was struck by these kind of quite stark, almost binaries, that, you know, this sort of very nihilistic kind of discourse on the one hand, this very, very sort of utopian and idealistic view of a world that could potentially be made so much better if technology were allowed to take its natural course and were not interfered with by big vested interests, and particularly sort of governmental interests. So it is a really interesting set of contradictions. One of the reasons that I talk about it within the framework of a kind of populism is, and if you think about the way in which populism has traditionally been studied as movements that can in many ways draw on a sort of a big idea, often quite an abstract idea. Ernesto Laclau, the political theorist, calls it a floating signifier, you know, this idea of the people or democracy or freedom that can sort of house within it some quite different and potentially contradictory interests if you look at them too closely. So Anonymous certainly contains expressions of quite sort of left-wing ideology on the one hand and quite sort of right-wing market anarchism on the other hand. It's a really interesting kind of, and I think quite sort of potent mix of very different ideals.
And can you see this in what they do? Can you see the reflections of these contradictory ideas in the actions that they take?
Well, I think the fact that they are outright opposed to any kind of governmental kind of role within the internet lends itself much more to that sort of libertarian worldview. And on the other hand, many of their sort of operations, particularly in more recent years, think about the way that street protests and so on have been very much framed as part of wider social justice struggles. And so yeah, I think we can see these kind of ideas, which are in standard ideological terms, maybe at odds with one another. And this is one of the things I'm trying to grapple with myself looking at these groups, is whether or not these are ideological tensions that really just kind of are bound at some point to pull the thing apart, or whether or not they genuinely, as I think many of the members of these groups see it, sort of transcending old divisions of left and right, or whether it's, on the other hand, this sort of uneasy amalgam of quite sort of left-right
ideologies. So there's like the idea of social justice on one hand, and yet you point out, for example, in your article, that there's quite a bit of rhetoric that could be construed as sexist, as racist, as homophobic.
Yes. I mean, the way in which freedom of speech is kind of sanctified by the movement, almost above all else, is really interesting. And I think, you know, the point about the use of, at times, sort of misogynistic or homophobic discourse, we see this less in recent years, I have to say. It's more from its sort of subcultural roots growing out of, as I discussed briefly in the article, this sort of 4chan forum online. One of the things I think we should be aware of when we're looking at the way in which Anonymous sanctifies free speech, and that sometimes seems to be in support of any kind of free speech, however offensive. So, for example, the anti-censorship, the anti-pornography filter operations that they've had. We should be careful not necessarily to assume that that maps neatly onto a kind of misogynistic worldviews, for example. I think, you know, this group is particularly interested in sort of pushing the boundaries, testing the boundaries of freedom of speech. And that's why in some of its sort of discourse, it deliberately invokes, you know, a kind of discourse which is self-consciously uncivil and politically incorrect at times, and that's perceived as part of that struggle.
And so what accounts for the organizations they decide to target? They targeted Scientology, they targeted Stratfor, the Westboro Baptist Church, a computer security firm, The Sun at a certain point.
Yep.
ISIS, right? So have you been able to make any sense out of the ethos and the targets, or does it not really fit well together?
It's partly that certainly in the past, any institution that is seen in any way to be trying to challenge freedom of speech or trying to shut down controversial opinions, for example, has been sort of fair game. But I also think that Anonymous is, as in terms of its ethos, is characterized by, you know, what we might see as a kind of quite binary view of the world, a quite sort of Manichaean idea of good versus evil. And once a group is identified as being on the side of evil, of which ISIS is a, you know, such an obvious kind of, you know, sort of moment in Anonymous history where they say, right, we've got to go after these guys, they're bad guys, and very obviously so. And so that sort of worldview does get manifested in its kind of actions and in its choice of target.
Plus, of course, ISIS, its attacks on Paris, and then they can connect into that the Charlie Hebdo kind of attack, which would be an attack on free speech, right?
Yes.
So that would fit in with its protection of speech.
Correct. And while many on the sort of progressive side of politics would say that the Charlie Hebdo case, appalling as it was, that there's some contextualization to be had in terms of the position of relative power that Charlie Hebdo had in terms of, you know, were they punching down, for example, in sort of targeting a particular religion. This idea that there's a sort of wider context to debates about free speech. For Anonymous, I think it's not that they are not capable of recognizing that wider context, but I think strategically they say, no, we must draw a line, and it's anything that is on the side of compromising freedom of speech must be targeted head-on.
So it would be a group that might even protect hate speech.
Correct, yes. Anonymous has been very careful to distinguish, for example, this isn't hate speech, but been very careful, for example, in its advocacy of total opposition to government-initiated anti-pornography filters on the internet. It's been very careful in recent times to make it clear that child pornography is a different issue. So there are lines clearly to be drawn. But once they are drawn, I think it's fair to say that these issues are seen in quite a binary way by the group. And again, we should recognize that that's in the context of activism. That has to be put in the context of a sort of tactical outlook. It's not necessarily that the members themselves aren't capable of discussing and reflecting on, and in fact they frequently do, the kind of nuances of particular issues within the movement itself.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the political ethos of hacktivist group Anonymous. Do you have a sense of how big the movement is?
In terms of numbers, no, I confess I don't, and I haven't really tried to get it.
It seems like it would be very hard.
It seems to almost be a futile kind of
exercise. Because it probably changes from moment to moment, I would think.
Absolutely, and that's one of the points about Anonymous, is that it doesn't have a membership committees, doesn't require people to undergo certain kind of periods of training or
so if you or I decided we wanted to hack into the University of Auckland's website because it was limiting somebody's free speech or whatever that happened to be, would we be able to claim we were part of Anonymous?
If you just go unilaterally and do it under the banner of Anonymous, without having consulted, without having brought other people with you, you are liable to bring down a storm of hate upon yourself. Now, the way in which operations emerge is not in a highly structured or hierarchical way. And we see, as actually happening as we speak with the Op ISIS, the Anonymous kind of operation to target ISIS, you do get loose cannon people doing things which somehow undermine the operation itself. And so there is this kind of trade-off. On the one hand, it's quite amorphous and quite a sort of emergent phenomenon rather than one which is premised on kind of discipline and hierarchy. But at the same time, if you simply, as an individual, were to claim the Anonymous moniker for an operation that was not bringing other people along with it, you would find yourself out in the cold very quickly.
So that's also that tension you talked about in the article between the collectivism and individualism.
Absolutely. There's a strong individualist ethos in ideological terms, the sanctity of the individual and the individual's right to freedom of speech and privacy. And yet there's very much a sort of collective mindset, very much a sort of sense of, you know, the hive mind, the collective wisdom of the crowd. Those sorts of ideas are very fundamental to this movement as well. So it's an interesting tension, and it's not necessarily an outright contradiction, but it challenges, I think, some of our traditional ways of trying to divide up different kind of worldviews.
Yeah, it's interesting in your other piece about populism as well. You talked about the populist heroes like Julian Assange now in this area and Snowden, for example, and how when you look a little bit closer at them, while they've been upheld as, say, left-wing heroes, there's really this very sort of right-wing aspect to them.
And again, these are sort of contradictory figures and hard to pin down in traditional ideological left-right terms. But I give the example of Assange and his sort of particular credo of market anarchism that he subscribes to, and yet not so much at the moment, but in the past certainly he has been co-opted as a sort of folk hero of the left and sort of celebrated by figures like John Pilger and Ken Loach, for example. Yet if you were to look at the ways in which Assange sort of sees the world, sees the future, understands how the internet should, for example, basically render international financial controls redundant, you know, that in many ways is that whole idea is kind of a nightmare. It's sort of anathema to many people on the left who think that the problem is that we've got too little financial
regulation
rather than too much.
Yeah, and similarly, you mentioned Snowden, and yet here's this guy who really loves his guns, and it is again a contradiction. And it's an interesting exercise for people who study framing, where you focus on some things, but you conveniently omit other things.
Yeah. And I have to say that's sort of drawing on information that's come out about Snowden based on sort of his. I should be careful not to claim that I actually really know where Edward Snowden lies currently on the sort of ideological spectrum. But yeah, he has been sort of brought forward by figures like Glenn Greenwald and the Guardian newspaper as a figure that the sort of liberal, progressive left can sort of co-opt for themselves. And yeah, if we look at some of the sentiments that these figures have expressed in the past, we would have to say, well, there's some really uneasy tensions there.
So in terms of the latest activities, we started to talk about the anonymous decision to go after ISIS. Because of these tensions, before we started taping, you talked about how some of the mistakes that have been made, targeting too broadly, for example. How do you see that all fitting together?
Again, this is partly the trade-off of a movement that is decentralized, that is premised on the idea that its activities grow quite organically and that organization happens sort of laterally. That's too simplistic, that there are hierarchies and people within the movement do sort of adopt and attain kind of positions of relatively, you know, relative power or status. But the idea is that there is this much greater fluidity to this movement. And of course, what that risks is, again, the sort of loose cannons. It risks, as is currently becoming evident in the criticism of Anonymous for the way it's targeting ISIS, that there are people casting the net far too widely. People are naive about who is actually part of IS and who, on the other hand, might just be promoting a particular viewpoint that they might find controversial or problematic. So it's, in many ways, it's a trade-off. It's not to suggest that this is, you know, not the way to run activism, but rather that it carries a lot of risks with it.
And then in terms of other hacktivist groups, how would you compare Anonymous to others? Do you have a sense of what the other hacktivist groups, are they similar or are they different?
I have to say that I haven't really put those under that kind of scrutiny. Obviously, I'm interested primarily in the way that politics and culture intersect and trying to understand Anonymous as a kind of, what drew me to Anonymous in the first case was as a sort of emerging sort of subcultural movement. And then that got me looking much more at its sort of political outlook and its political operations.
I've been thinking in terms of, so they've come up with the term hacktivist, so people who are activists via hacking. Then we've got the clicktivists, people who, that's all they do. And then, of course, there are the slacktivists. So how do you see all this in terms of the emergent political terrain?
I think the term slacktivist, and to a lesser extent clicktivist, has really sort of taken on a kind of almost a sort of moralizing kind of hue to it, that actually, and we're moving away here from hacking activities. We're moving here towards talking about people who use the internet to undertake some kind of action, whether it's pledging a small amount of money to a particular organization, crowdfunding a particular project, or simply expressing approval.
Signing a petition
likes and so on.
So would you see this on a spectrum?
Yes, absolutely. But I think I would be very wary, though, of putting slacktivism at one end and so-called real activism at the other end. I think it's much more complex than that. And I'm very wary of people who use the term slacktivist too easily, too dismissively, to really argue that unless you're doing things in a kind of quite traditional way, unless you're out on the streets, that somehow you're not affecting any kind of meaningful change. But I think the term slacktivism has helped to sort of bring forward some interesting debates about what the internet really does offer for activists and many of its sort of inherent limitations as well as its strengths. And certainly the relatively unbounded optimism that was kind of about the internet and its potential to energize people as activists and to become more active citizens and so on. A lot of that sort of unbounded optimism has sort of waned in recent years as people have become a little bit more world-weary and a little bit more skeptical about what you can achieve by doing stuff online. Obviously, the Kony campaign was and is still singled out as the obvious sort of example. And in many ways, it's a slightly unfair example because it's the one spectacular failure, if you like, that people sort of draw on. So it's a really complex field. I think what interests me about what connects these things is, and one of the reasons I use the sort of framing of populism, and by the way, I don't use that in a wholly derogatory way, is this sort of sense of kind of technological immediacy, this idea that you can insert technology into the equation and somehow short-circuit traditional institutions of politics and democracy, that somehow you can cut straight to the chase and actually affect change directly through the internet. And I think we're seeing that that's actually a hugely simplistic way of looking at the world.
Except for there are hackers, maybe not anonymous per se, but maybe anonymous, who do wield more power, at least momentarily.
Perhaps.
With the potential to wreck an entire financial institution, for example.
Yes, although the long-term consequences of that are more questionable, I think. And it's understandable completely in the sort of times that we live in that there's a kind of, that there's this huge wave of impatience with the kind of slow mode of traditional politics that leads people to look for and to want some kind of more immediate, hard-hitting way to make an impact on the world. And yet it may be that we need to recognize, in fact, that the kind of long, slow, boring work of institutional reform is actually still kind of essential in some ways to making sort of long-term changes. And a lot of these movements really are quite disdainful of those forms of politics and kind of dismiss them as being outmoded and irrelevant to our digital world. And I think that's a really sort of problematic and simplistic way of looking at things.
Thank you so much, Luke Good, for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Luke Good is a senior lecturer in media, film, and television at the University of Auckland and the author of the book, Jürgen Habermas, Democracy in the Public Sphere. He has also published widely on social media, citizen journalism, and hacktivism. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.